It's really good to be with you here today and to be reminded that the risen Christ makes all the difference. One time William Penn said, "See thou lovest what is lovely." By that he meant, see that you love only that which is lovely. He was warning against misplaced affection. This world woos us. This world dangles promises of delight before our eyes. Embracing those promises yields just enough pleasure for just long enough to ensnare and enslave. There are some people who are reluctant to discuss worldliness because then they might have to change. If I think too seriously about this, I might have to let go of some things I enjoy. But the Father's warning, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. That warning does not rob us of any real, fruitful joy. If the world, in the usual New Testament sense, were lovely, then it would deserve our love. Since it only pretends to be lovely, it deserves to be unmasked. A love of the world begins in the soul. I asked Kevin to read that portion from the book of Genesis that he read for us a while ago. It's not a pleasant portion to read out loud in the assembly of the saints. It's not the most comfortable part of Scripture to read. I thought I was merciful in that I didn't have him continue on through the rest of the chapter because it only gets worse. Nevertheless, it is part of Scripture and we need to be reminded of it at times. But every time I read that, I think if I only had this part of the life of Lot, as it's told here in the book of Genesis, I might never have imagined that Lot was really a true believer in God. Yet Peter tells us in the New Testament three times that Lot, this conflicted, compromised man, was righteous. Peter tells us that Lot was distressed and tormented by his life in Sodom. Even though Lot was revolted by Sodom, it seems that Sodom was in his soul. Lot had to be taken by the hand and dragged from the city of Sodom. This shows us that it is possible for a believer in God to be distressed by the world while still willfully clinging to the world. When Lot was delivered, he made a whimpering plea to his angelic deliverers not to have to go to the hills, but rather to go to the mini-Sodom of Zoar. And from there, he descended into the cave with his daughters. There's every evidence that righteous Lot was of no benefit to the inhabitants of Sodom. Even though he lived in Sodom for years and was prominent in his gates by the end of his tenure there. It seems that Lot's words carried little, if any, weight. It seems that none of his family or friends feared God. Maybe Lot's words had no substance because Lot was so insubstantial himself. Lot's life had apparently done nothing to loosen the culture's grip on his wife. She left her heart in Sodom and couldn't resist turning around and looking back. Lot's daughters absorbed the spirit of Sodom into their soul. They had become deceptive. Deception was a way of life in Sodom. Inwardly, Lot was greatly distressed, but outwardly it seems that he said little or nothing. He had become a prominent man in the town, and perhaps he didn't speak out for that reason. His daughters saw his accommodating behavior, his accommodating character. Perhaps his girls could not forget that he had offered them to appease the inflamed men of Sodom in his infamous betrayal of fatherly duty. Lot should have been willing to die rather than let those men have his girls. Instead, he offered them. And when the monumental degradation of the father-daughter seductions occurred, his daughters used the craft that he had bequeathed to them. It was his wine. It was his deceit. It was his betrayal, mixed together and served in a dark cup in the depths of the cave. His daughter's dishonor of him was adroit and it was cunning. With cruel irony, Lot himself carried out the shameful act that he had first suggested to the men of Sodom. Lot had sown Sodom in the hearts of his daughters. Though the worldliness of Sodom vexed his righteous soul, he lived as close to the world as he could. First he had pitched his tent toward Sodom, and then he moved into it, and then he was in the gate. There's a graduality here that's frightening. We all know the story of the frog slowly boiling to death, because it's so incremental, because it's so gradual. Though God condemned all of Sodom except Lot and his daughters, Sodom was reborn in their very lives. It is possible for we believers who are truly distressed by the course of this world to live lives that are so profoundly influenced by culture that Sodom is reborn in the lives of those we love the most. Lot's life is a paradigm of many lives today who are at once both appalled and enthralled by the world. The world is subtle. It's often undetected by those who are slowly succumbing to its lies. We become desensitized to the clear and present danger of worldliness. The enticements have never been more powerful. These are crucial days, culturally and spiritually. We are on the tide of unparalleled cultural change. The church's job is not to save the culture, but to rescue the perishing. Individuals out of the culture who will come to Christ. God warns us against the loving of the world because he knows that we incline to do so. For a moment, let's think about two questions. What percentage of the people in this congregation do you personally consider worldly? And then another question, do you consider yourself worldly? Our answers to those two questions might reveal that we see more worldliness in others than we see in ourselves. How can half of us be worldly if hardly any of us are worldly? It's easy to dismiss worldliness as applying only to those who we think are more worldly than us. The lawyer that Jesus talked to in the 10th chapter of Luke was willing to justify himself. In Genesis 3 with Adam and Eve, we see the sinner's reflexive reluctance to admit sin. The flesh almost always thinks it's better than it is. Without searching the scriptures in a self-examining way, we tend to assume that God agrees with us. If any man among you seemeth to be wise in this world, let him become a fool that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. 1 Corinthians 3:18 and 19. Setting ourselves apart from the world is not so much a series of no's as it is one immense yes to Christ. It's Jesus Christ who is risen who supplies the perspective to say no as we ought and when we ought. The stakes are high. If we are not very careful, Lot's folly could be ours. None of us in this 21st century has anything to say that will truly help us on this or any other topic until we have first learned what God has already said. And there's hardly a page of Scripture that lacks information relevant to worldliness. Along with the biblical teaching, we must also pursue contemporary application. And the tricky thing is that loves we have already formed are likely to distort our judgment here. For example, if I have already learned to love to gamble, then it's easy to find justification for that. We need principles to guide our application. Our culture is full of deadly toxins and pathogens. Anything that provides safe haven for ungodliness is something other than the saving grace of God. I think most of us understand how we're using the word world in the context of worldliness. It's those aspects of human culture in which believers show their rejection of and in which unbelievers show their rejection of and their unwillingness to follow God. They show even their hostility toward God. Human cultures are sinners' cultures. The goal of worldly people is to move forward rather than to move upward. They seek outward prosperity rather than holiness. If they don't deny God, they at the very least ignore Him or forget Him, or use Him only for their own selfish ends. Worldliness is human nature without God. Worldliness is a man-centered way of thinking. Worldliness judges the importance of things by the present and material results. Worldliness weighs success by numbers. Worldliness covets human esteem and wants no unpopularity. It knows no truth that's worth suffering for. It declines to be a fool for Christ's sake. Worldliness is the mindset of the unregenerate. It worships idols and is at war with God. Worldliness is inside of us in the cravings of sinful man. The evil in our desires often lies not in what we want, but in the fact that we want it too much. And legitimate desires then become false gods. A legitimate desire for financial success becomes a silent demand for financial success. An interest in clothes and fashions becomes a preoccupation. Love of music morphs into an obsession. Desire to enjoy a program becomes a need to see the latest. Our hearts are a perpetual factory for idols. When we must have these things, we've succumbed to idolatry. Our eyes are a precious gift from God, but they provide opportunities not just to observe, but to covet. Practically anything we see can stimulate greed in our souls. What images have the power to arouse your interest? It's probably whatever is coming to your mind right now as you consider that question. If you're more excited about the release of a new movie or a new video game than you are about serving in the local congregation, if you're drawn to people more because of their physical attractiveness or personality than their character, if you're impressed by Hollywood stars and professional athletes, regardless of their lack of integrity or morality, then you may be being seduced by this fallen world. The world, as used in the context of worldliness, is the bad part of culture. There's no future in worldliness. This world is temporary, this world is superficial, and it does not satisfy long term. It doesn't deliver as advertised. It deceives us. It delivers unadvertised consequences. Sin carries with it the very seeds of dissatisfaction and destruction. For most Americans, media is the omnipresent backdrop of life. Media is so engulfing that it seems like a second atmosphere. Television is the single most significant shared reality in our entire society. To gain the audience they need to survive, mass media appeal to sinful lusts. The packaging and delivering have advanced technologically, but the substance has remained as primitive as a talking serpent. We watch by habit. We unwatchingly watch. We thoughtlessly watch. We watch because others watch. We watch because, quote, there's nothing else to do, end quote. If you and I live purposefully and intentionally, then when we watch on purpose, and then we turn it off. Resist the lifestyle of passive viewing. Look out for the dulling of conscience over time, because conscience is being resisted or conscience is being ignored. The searing and losing of feeling is insidious. It's gradual. It's like that frog boiling. Here's an interesting thing. In a Roper survey, 96% of people polled claimed that they watch less TV than the average person. You ever notice how many people will go out of their way to tell you how little time they spend on Facebook? Ever notice how gamblers consistently underestimate their losses? Why? The answer to all of these may well be the same. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Our battle is with the flesh. The desires of the flesh fight against the desires of the Spirit to keep you from doing what you want to do. Galatians 6:17. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed, lest he fall. 1 Corinthians 10:12. Television is the single most potent influence in Western civilization. Statistics say that the viewing habits of Christians are generally the same as the rest of the culture. That's Christian defined by those who made the statistics. There is no place where television is flexing its muscles more in 2014 than in the alteration of America's sexual mores and practices. I was in some people's house not long ago. A man was flipping through the channels. He came across an old episode of Dragnet. Most of you are old enough to remember Dragnet from years ago. This was an old episode of Dragnet from, I'd say, the late 60s probably. And just as he was flipping through, the statement was made on that program. It was made by Sergeant Friday, the hero of the program, that at that particular time, he said, quote, even homosexuality is being advocated. In other words, he was saying in the late 60s, things are now getting so bad, so outrageous, that even homosexuality is being advocated, end quote. Well, today, if you've seen any sitcoms, you know the story. How far we've come in the wrong direction. Prior to 1969, fewer than one instance of extramarital sex occurred in every 30 television shows. During the 1970s, extramarital sex was featured in 1 out of 8 shows. Is there a drama or a sitcom at all on television today that does not have extramarital sex? And married sexuality is actually played down on TV. In cultivating purity in the church, no tactic is more important than celebrating and elevating marriage. To deny that there is a conscious assault on Christian values is like believing that Al-Qaeda or ISIS are trying to build a kinder, gentler world. TV programming is dictated by profit, but also by a moral agenda, or should I say an immoral agenda. Television promotes passivity, it shortens attention spans, it inhibits thinking, it creates distance. People will look at anything rather than at each other. Whenever we watch sin portrayed without consequence, we're subject to deception no matter how strong we think we are. Sin without judgment dulls our sensitivity to God's hatred of sin. In that passage Kevin read, we see the sin and then we see the judgment. On the average television show, we just see the sin. We don't see any judgment. In fact, we often see sin rewarded. In the Old Testament, the adulterer and the adulteress were to be put to death, Leviticus 10, verse 20. Why does that seem extreme to me and you? Why? Because we're conditioned by our culture to think otherwise. It's simply because we no longer have a healthy view of the blazing glory of God. He is of purer eyes than to behold evil, Habakkuk 1:13. When we're enticed to laugh about immorality, our resistance is weakened. We see adulterers flaunt their adultery and live happily ever after. Sexual immorality is anything but beautiful, no matter how attractive the actors are, no matter how sentimental the plot is, no matter how touching the dialogue, no matter how romantic the soundtrack. God commands us not to be deceived. It's only fools who lack a fear of God. There are a lot of questions we can ask about our television watching. As I am watching, am I skipping or delaying something that's important to watch this show? What are my other social or entertainment options beside watching TV or watching a movie? How much time have I already spent on media today? How much time have I spent surfing the internet? In the last week, how much time have I spent on spiritual disciplines? How much time have I spent building relationships or serving compared to time spent consuming media? After investing the time to view this program, will I look back on that as time well spent? Why is it that I want to watch this particular program or film? What do I find entertaining about it? Am I trying to escape from something that I should be facing? Am I seeking comfort or relief that can really be found only in God? What sinful temptations will this program present? Am I deceiving myself? Am I watching this simply because I'm bored or lazy? Am I watching simply because others are? How have my online relationships affected my face-to-face relationships? How has my online activity impacted my soul, for better or worse? What worldview does this program present? Is sin shown as having negative consequences? Will seeing this help me to better understand God's world? Does its content or artistry reflect truth, beauty, and goodness? There are many things we can research before watching. And forewarned is forearmed. We can have a process of deciding if we should view, what we should view, and how we should view. All things are lawful, but all things are not helpful. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. What if we test our media consumption? And what if the standard is looking for those things that might be beneficial instead of what might be merely permissible? Psalm 101, verse 2. I will not set before my eyes anything that is worthless. Is there anybody in your life who knows what you watch or how much you watch? Accountable viewing blesses us with a clear conscience. I believe that discernment and adjustment are perhaps needed for some of us, if not most of us. I think that for probably most of us, discernment and discretion will mean watching less than we currently do. There are a world of things to do with the television off. Groucho Marx once said, "I find television very educational. Every time somebody switches it on, I go to another room and read a book." Groucho Marx is also the man who said, "Outside of a dog, books are man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read." I like Groucho in some ways. Find a balance that enriches your life. If you can't control television, get rid of it. It's better to go through life with no TV than to go to hell with your remote in your hand. We're going to conclude this morning by once again extending the Lord's invitation. We've hardly scratched the surface of the general subject of worldliness, but we have addressed one specific issue regarding that I think we all need to consider. We need to take God seriously, and we need to take Him at His Word as presented in His Word. If there is someone here today who is with us, who is outside of Christ and needs to come to the Lord in simple trusting faith, if you have anything to bring before the brethren who are assembled here together today, please let us know how we can assist you as we stand together and sing an invitation number.